Apocalypse Not, Practical Security Against State-Sponsored Shenanigans. Copyright 2019 by Wakefield Cybersecurity LLC. All rights reserved. Recorded January 9 in Bellbrook, Ohio. My name is Mark Abel, and I'm the owner of and principal cybersecurity consultant for Wakefield Cybersecurity, located near Dayton, Ohio. You can find me on the web at wakesecure.com. This is a hard talk for me to give. The topic is too broad, protecting Americans against online attacks by foreign actors. For one thing, I'd have to account for about 30 years of computer history to show why things are going so poorly, why our nation's database of information vulnerabilities has grown by more than 18,000 problems just in 2018. That's a new security-related bug published every half hour, and many of these bugs affect multiple platforms and software versions on millions of machines, making any simple count of the bugs a naive understatement of the problem. I'd have to look closely at industry practices, how software is financed, and how buyers respond to this financing. I'd have to talk about how the wrong developers are hired into positions which shouldn't exist to begin with, while software testing and cybersecurity posts are filled with people who need to be expert programmers, but aren't programmers at all. I'd have to mention the various magazines and blogs programmers have read since around 1990 that are full of bad advice on handling projects and engineering reliable systems, as well as the failure of language fads like C++ and Java to help programmers write better code. I'd have to talk about our supply chain and why we keep buying chips manufactured in rival countries that we have no way of inspecting, connect those chips directly to the internet, and load them with information about our bank accounts, our family members, and patents we are about to apply for. And that's just the first few things that come into my head. There's so much here that my gears get gummed up, my head goes around in circles, and I find myself unable to say anything, as if my brain has come under a denial of service attack after studying this topic for years. In picking this subject, I've taken on more than I am qualified to speak to, putting at risk my mission to advance some important ideas. Now, the reason I'm sharing so much personal angst about this talk is because it's a good analogy for understanding information security problems in general. We've become a civilization of cyber gluttons in an age of free downloads and supersized solutions. And the problem with our piggishness is that we haven't learned to keep our computing truly under human control. There's so much software on our machines that the works get gummed up. The cooling fans spin faster and faster, but the machines seem to work slower and slower. It's one thing if we want to be, for example, movie gluttons. We can buy terabytes of movies if we want. We can store them on whatever media we like, and they'll probably be there when we want to watch them. Movies are inert, and we do a fairly good job keeping them under human control. Software is different from movies. Anyone in this room can easily manage a terabyte collection of random movies. It doesn't matter what they're about or who the directors were. All you need is a few dozen Blu-rays. The same isn't true of software. It's unlikely that any of us here, or all of us working together, can reliably control even 1 megabyte of machine code by an unknown writer. And since it takes 1 million megabytes to make a terabyte, we see quickly that a diverse collection of software is more than 1 million times harder to manage than a collection of the most exotic films. Let's take a little time to figure out what we mean by cybersecurity. A widely cited standard here is ISO 27000, which defines information security as follows: preservation of confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information. I'll say it again since this talk doesn't have slides. Information security means preservation of confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information, according to ISO 27000. The only thing I can say in support of this definition is it sounds good and was approved by a committee. But the objectives in this definition don't even apply consistently. Wikipedia articles, for example, aren't confidential. Email systems don't need and frequently don't have continuous availability. If any hop along a message's path isn't up, the message will be held for a reasonable time so the hop can succeed later. As for integrity, just look at Twitter. Some people tweet such outrageous things that it wouldn't matter if even Russia changes a few messages here and there. Yet all three systems do reasonably need information security. We just need to know what security means in each situation. Here is the definition I use for my practice. Cybersecurity is the discipline of scaling automation responsibly. We start from the perspective of a process that needs automation to be practical or economical, and then we add automation in a manner that tries to not involve negative repercussions. A key point that I make when I talk is that to increase security, you need to reduce complexity. And you continue to reduce complexity until either you failed, your objective is no longer reachable, or you've reached an adequate level of security. Now, reducing complexity doesn't mean you improve the user interface, although sometimes that's part of the result. One of today's paradoxes of computer security is the Nest thermostat. I like to joke that when my office building installed one, I moved out right afterward. It's true that I moved, but the Nest had nothing to do with it. Instead, my company was out of space. What I loved about the Nest is how easy the display is to read. It has 90,000 some pixels, full color, and lights up in the dark. That alone makes it the most convenient programmable thermostat I've ever seen. But I find the 512 megabytes of RAM and another 512 megabytes of non-volatile memory in the current generation disturbing. The cost for you to audit the thermostat's code and its updates could easily be thousands of times more than what it will save you on energy bills. It turns out you can make an easy-to-read thermostat without using any RAM at all. You use a bimetallic strip and a mercury switch, and you can still buy them. They don't turn themselves up and down for you, but Iran won't be hacking them. As another way to look at complexity, today's computing solutions are like plastic grocery bags. It's convenient to bury used grocery bags in landfills, but it's simpler from a process standpoint to avoid bagging groceries. If you forgo the plastic bag, you don't have to drill holes in the planet looking for petroleum to make the plastic out of. You don't have to pump oil out of the ground, ship it halfway around the world, or manufacture the bag. You don't have to deal with Saudi Arabia, which is getting harder these days, or Venezuela, persuade Congress to let you drill in the Gulf of Mexico, clean up a 200 million gallon spill when your offshore rig catches fire and sinks, or pick up a $65 billion tab to settle 400,000 court cases. Likewise in cybersecurity, I look at process simplicity and stay away from crazy measures that are the software equivalent of drilling for combustible fluids and explosive vapors under 5,100 feet of water in the open sea in a hurricane zone. The Nest thermostat is the deep water horizon of home automation. You might not want to hang around the platform. An important question in computer security is going to be, how much code can one person realistically understand and be able to audit? Let's assume we get to hand select all the code we're going to run, and we'll never have to execute something we don't understand. Let's also assume we can hand pick our auditors and use only the brightest 1% of the talent pool. How much code can this team take on? It turns out that humans can't understand much code at all unless we stick to some very rigid forms. When I took computer algorithms from Manny Chandy, there were about 15 or 20 students in the room. Some undergrads, some grad students. Manny would put short snippets of code on the projector, typically 7 to 10 lines, and we would spend most of the class together trying first of all to understand what that code did, and second, whether the implementation was correct or not. Now, picture this room I was in, full of computer scientists who would soon graduate from Caltech, nearly stumped, looking at less than a dozen lines of perfectly legible source code. And Manny, being an MIT graduate, had an interesting kick at the time. He made his students learn how to write software that was a proof of its own correctness. If it's hard for gifted programmers to understand 10 lines of a distributed computing algorithm, then a definitive audit of a large distributed computing application like Mozilla Firefox is out of the question. The source code for Firefox 64 contains 258,000 files. Not lines, 258,000 files. And that's without including dependencies on other packages which Mozilla doesn't even control. And there are dozens of them. So, let's consider a different approach to making software safe in the presence of attackers. We have very fast computers with lots of memory, so why don't we use that computing power to examine the code we're going to run to see if it does malicious things or has remotely exploitable defects? In other words, let's have an automated look at how our code is written as a way to filter out problems before they happen. This approach is called static program analysis. And one of the security industry's dirty secrets is that static program analysis doesn't work today, and never will. You might ask, how can I say this? What gives me the nerve to tell you that every virus scanner is broken and can't be fixed, and that no computer will ever be built that can look at a segment of code and say every time whether that code is safe or unsafe? The reason is that an American named Henry Gordon Rice proved it in his doctoral dissertation. Is this news to you, that it's mathematically proven that you can't build a malware scanner that works 100% of the time? It gets even more interesting when we think about how long we've known about the problem. Rice submitted his doctoral dissertation in 1951, 3 years before Morris Tannenbaum made the first silicon transistor. One of the disturbing aspects of Rice's theorem can be found in what it doesn't say. It doesn't say a program has to be large before its behavior is computationally undecidable. We can write 12-line programs that no human can predict the outcome of, and worse, we can easily design 12-line programs where we know what they will do, but no one else can learn by reading our source code. People who sell virus scanning software will tell you I have it wrong. They might try to pass me off as an academic who can't recognize when a system is good enough to sell. They'll tell you that all you really need to do is stay a step ahead of your adversaries. They know how to build programs that recognize millions of different flavors of malware. So if they keep updating those programs, you'll keep buying them again every month. The problem with this plan is that malware scanners are too brittle. If you play Russian roulette with one bullet and 999 empty chambers, your odds sound good in the first round, but you'll be dead very soon. And if all your friends play this evening, one will be gone by morning. So malware scanners, here's the thing. Once our retirement plan has been drained and wired to Barbados, our pension is gone. Once the generator's burned out at the hospital, the life support equipment stops working. We can't play the same game again and again where we hope our adversaries don't have a so-called zero-day vulnerability. That is, a way to break our systems before any fix is available. And even if an automatic update was available in time for each of the 18,022 vulnerabilities that NIST published last year, maybe not every chemical plant's network connection has the 99.99% uptime needed to install the fixes as they become available. Remember, too, that network connectivity is not an all-or-nothing game. The network connection to your supplier of the malware profiles to allow your scans to work could be down, while your network connection to North Korea is just fine. So when we talk about cybersecurity, we need to become impassioned about rejecting bad solutions. When the scale of our computing environment exceeds our ability to manage it, adding security is no longer a viable fix. It doesn't matter if the security comes from human methods or automated ones. The combination of complexity and sheer size guarantees that we're going to lose. So, as a really cynical security geek, what do I have to offer you? My answer is that you can choose what game you're playing. You can be in a cat-and-mouse race with North Korea, China, Iran, and Russia. Automate your whole business to today's industry norms. You can resign yourself to thinking that, of course, computers are going to be insecure, so we should hire a cybersecurity company to come in. It's called Defense in Depth. They can monitor our networks, scan our systems, and fly in a whole plane of emergency responders after a breach is discovered. Or we can get out of that game. Let me show you something. This is an accounting system. What you're hearing is a machine called a soroban. It's Japan's version of the Roman abacus. It's a rectangular frame about the size of a large ruler, holding 27 plastic rods, a little thicker than toothpicks. On each rod are 5 beads, about the size of blueberries, with a divider running through each rod so that 4 beads are on one side and the 5th bead is on the opposite side. The 4 beads count as 1, 10, 100, and so on, depending on the rod, and the remaining beads count as 5, 50, 500, and so on. This soroban has 135 beads in total. A skilled user can add and subtract 27-digit numbers, as well as multiply, divide, and extract roots from smaller numbers. It's amazingly fast in the right hands, and although it looks tedious to learn, it's a lot easier to master than computer programming. It's easy to inspect and see it hasn't been tampered with, and importantly, this soroban can't be hacked into from Russia. To first order, computations I do on this soroban in this room are going to be safe. Now, I don't expect you to move all your calculations to a soroban as a practical solution to real-life cybersecurity concerns. But there is a point here. A soroban used in a private location is entirely under human control. By resigning from the arms race with North Korea, you've essentially won that race permanently. Our job is to emerge carefully from being soroban users in bathroom stalls to computer and network users in locations that better suit us. But we have to keep that soroban promise in our hearts. We're not going to let our automation escape our control. How to emerge from your closets and Faraday cages to work safely in the real world will depend on your style and priorities. Perhaps you've seen Oliver Stone's film Snowden. You may remember how Ed keeps confiscating the journalist's cell phones and stashing them in the microwave oven. He doesn't actually nuke the phones. He's simply using the oven's protective shielding to prevent the phones from maintaining a connection to the cell tower. Not only can the microphones not transmit while the phones are in the microwave, but also no one can triangulate on the phone's signals to find and arrest Snowden while he's being interviewed in Hong Kong. So about these phones in the microwave. I run a cybersecurity company, and I need to reach people in private. What about my own cell phone? Where is it right now, and what protocols do I follow to make sure it's not being used to my own detriment? Do I have a microwave in the back of my car? Some people put their phone in a metal cocktail shaker. That works too. Is there one of those in my briefcase? No, but some of you listening already know what I do. I got rid of my cell phone in 1995. Haven't had one since. If someone needs to call me while we're together today, it can wait. You're more important right now. My family doesn't need to be able to reach me this instant. My wife was in the military. I've gone for weeks without being able to reach her, months without being able to see her, and nothing bad happened. Same for our daughter, who also doesn't have a cell phone and doesn't want one. Your information security decisions won't always be the same as mine, but you'll be faced with the same types of choices and be using the same principles to make your decisions. Faced with a really hard information security problem, how to be in touch with people safely, I chose to jettison a little convenience and a lot of complexity in favor of maintaining confidentiality. You might think I didn't get a good enough deal, that if all I get is security, maybe I'd be better off if I could carry a phone. But security isn't the only benefit. Remember my wife and daughter? They don't interrupt me when I go out. And more importantly, no one else bothers me either. There's one less phone number to share and keep current with 100 friends. No phone bills, no minutes to keep track of, no dropped connections, no charger to remember to bring, no cocktail shaker either, no texts coming in while I'm passing a truck on the freeway, and no ringer going off in the middle of the Dayton Philharmonic. Having no cell phone also improves cybersecurity at the office. How? Because cell phones are a nightmare to secure, and the time and expense I don't have to spend on a cell phone can be applied to securing my office network, which is much easier, and having no mobile phone, that much more of a target to protect. Mainstream information security as a profession suffers some problems. Remember that ISO 27000 defines information security as the preservation of confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information. Now, I love precise terminologies. I have often implemented or evaluated against international standards, and I acknowledge there are points where abstraction, the application of uniform principles to diverse situations and technologies, is useful. All three worked great for quality management systems. For example, where the ISO 9000 series of standards has given enormous improvement to an entire world. It didn't matter if you were buying an automobile or an avocado. The base principles for controlling quality and assuring consistent outcomes depended more on management processes than on mastery of engineering or agricultural particulars. A professional working in quality could be dispatched to either industry without particular knowledge of either production process. To first order, quality turns out to be a bolt-on feature that can be architected and supervised by people who know only about quality, not about the rest of the product. Cybersecurity, unfortunately, is not a peripheral. It can't be sourced separately from the rest of a system and get plugged in when production is almost done. It is not like quality, where a paraprofessional from a distinct and separate field of knowledge can walk into a semiconductor fabrication plant or oversee a software development project and contribute much of anything. It's my observation that someone trained only in quality can deliver quality. But someone trained only in cybersecurity cannot make a system secure. Cybersecurity as a professional study of its own is an accident at best, and a pretense at worst. The reason the computer security profession is so different from the quality profession is that the former must completely change the characteristics of objects that are being controlled. If you add quality to an automobile maker, the manufactured outcome is essentially the same car with fewer lemons in the batch. Quality in a meat plant still produces chicken, but you'll find less cartilage at the table. Cybersecurity works differently in that vulnerable systems cannot be made secure. They require redesign from the transistor up. We can't cordon off insecure from secure devices in the way we might pull apples with worms off the shelf. Manufacturing variances can cause a single assembly plant to make cars that will turn out okay, as well as ones that will present nightmares. But if a single copy of Windows 10 Enterprise has vulnerabilities, the rest of the run can fare no better. ISO 27000 defines words like risk analysis, a technology-agnostic term of the security profession. But it makes no mention of domain-specific knowledge for building secure devices or software such as reticule or speculative execution. Don't let me lose you here. You don't need to know what these things are. But you do need to know that when a system architect messes up either of these things, you have a defective and very probably insecure system. Traditional cybersecurity people don't deal in these subjects because there aren't enough people with skills in these areas to staff the contracting firms. Instead, we get people out of VOTEC schools with certificates saying they've mastered the lingo of ISO 27000, and possibly a little penetration testing using tools they wouldn't know how to design. Traditional cybersecurity people are guaranteed steady jobs because with their 24/7 system monitoring, compliance audits, and ethical hacking, they squander money that might otherwise have been spent making systems immune to breaches in the first place. And notwithstanding hundreds of thousands of vacancies in exactly these skills, people who have them are much easier to find and market than people who are going to make an actual difference. This points to a significant problem with today's market for technical labor. We are in a cybersecurity hiring bubble, just like the post-2013 cryptocurrency bubble. Tens of thousands of jobs are being created like so many elevator operator positions. We can pay people to work in these jobs for a while, but approaches which don't require these jobs to exist in the first place are going to prevail. Whose condition will the current labor bubble improve, with the exception of technical recruiters? Quality and security also differ from a user's perspective. I can buy a high-quality forklift or a low-quality forklift, but as a forklift driver, I'm not going to be inconvenienced if I own the better one. In actuality, life will be happier and easier with the better product. But a secure software package is a different story altogether. It won't function in the same manner as an insecure package because its features will be different. It will be designed differently, and its publisher will have different objectives. In computing, we tend to choose complex systems because they're what vendors happen to be pushing our way. Usually the process we're trying to automate isn't really that complex, but the software we latch on to do the automation is hyperkill. We can make our systems much safer, administration much easier, and hiring much more flexible if we are willing to make drastic cuts to the scale of our solutions. Writing those occasional 500 lines of code to avoid linking in 50,000 line libraries, and becoming proficient in general data handling skills like writing in Python, instead of application-specific administrative skills like setting up Apache web server. A business I worked with last year did everything by the book. Install the best tools for the job at hand. Use open source solutions. Run the latest versions. Don't reinvent the wheel by writing code that someone better qualified has already written. They developed neat products in diverse fields, and they built markets for those products. They're more successful in their business than I am in mine. But they had some concerns about information security and asked for my feedback so that they could head off potential breaches. And here's what I told them. This company runs very simple web-based services, and they use a traditional LAMP stack on the back end. That is, they run Linux for the operating system, Apache web server, MySQL as the database, and PHP, their scripting language. And as software updates are disruptive, expensive, and bring new risks, none had been applied for quite some time. I'll be frank here. My client was correct in not upgrading their software. That gut feeling of don't do it is completely valid. Their products are so simple that from a security perspective, there is very little that should be able to go wrong, and the data they were protecting was not vitally critical. But there was a problem with their traditional mindset to application development. My client's problem was that the LAMP stack is too heavy for the application they were supporting, and no one ever gets fired for choosing LAMP, especially if one replaces PHP, which has 558 vulnerabilities published by NIST as of December 31st, with Python, which has just 34. I'll repeat that. PHP has 558 vulnerabilities, while Python has 34, and Python has had 5 more years for problems to occur. When I looked at the version numbers of what my customer was running, except for the Linux kernel itself, everything had become old, and there were over 400 publicly known vulnerabilities, of which more than 70 had a critical rating under the Common Vulnerability Scoring System. So what should this company do? My industry's solution would be to update PHP, MySQL, and Apache to the most recent version. You get a clean slate, a fresh start, and a new life. But wait a second. My customer started with a clean slate at the outset, and everything broke simply by aging. Is there a better way? I think there is. I told my client that if they were willing to write 5,000 lines of code in Python, and that was an outer figure. I thought the number was closer to 2,500. They could eliminate Apache web server, MySQL, and PHP. They'd have to add Python, but even factoring that in, their solution would be 11 million lines lighter. Any future vulnerabilities that might be discovered in Apache, MySQL, and PHP would be irrelevant for this company. Their system would be completely immune to those problems. In terms of return on investment, what should my client do? Is it worth it to allocate a Python developer for 5,000 lines knowing she might make unnoticed mistakes? Is having 5,000 lines of code written by one's own team, knowing your limitations and workload, safer than allowing 11 million lines of industry-leading, frequently reviewed open-source programs? To answer that, we can look at a few other numbers. Although defect rates in software vary between projects and teams, it's common to estimate that for every 1,000 lines of software you have, there are about 3 defects. These defects can lead to vulnerabilities that are exploitable by Iran and their ilk. So if we find 3 defects on average in 1,000 lines, then 11 million lines is going to have 33,000 defects. My recommendation to this company was that eliminating 33,000 defects would be immensely beneficial and far outweigh the modest cost of writing a few thousand lines of software they otherwise wouldn't have to. Even if they made 100 mistakes in what they write, they'll still have about 33,000 fewer errors and 11 million fewer lines to look for them in. They would eliminate all future dependence on multiple projects they don't control. No longer need administrators who know a smidgen of the SQL language or how to configure Apache, and no longer users of that disastrous language, PHP. They would only need someone who is adept in Python and this company's modest applications. And get this, for every line of code they would have to sweat out in Python, they would eliminate 6 defects. Integration and diagnostics would be simpler and more to the point, and expansion to add more features would be straightforward. In other words, this company can recover their next security investment solely from non-security benefits. The desired increase in security for them turns out to be free. And despite my cell phone shunning Soroban slashing stance, the modest inconvenience of having to actually know a programming language and write in it is heavily outweighed by gains in convenience and cost savings in other efforts. Rather than upgrade all that software they have, my customer can mothball it and move on. But we don't have to stop with this example yet. Remember those vulnerability counts I gave for what this company had? I left out the Linux kernel, which has over 1,100 published vulnerabilities for the version they were running. I went on to suggest that this client could eliminate at least another 10 million lines of code if they moved to a smaller operating system, such as one of the BSDs or possibly Minix 3. An important myth we can bust is that software develops security flaws as it gets older. For example, Windows XP is too old to be safe, which is why support ended in 2014. And to be fair to Microsoft, let's observe that security patches were provided for more than 12 years. But guess what? I have 3 TRS-80s at my office, and I just used one of them Monday. All are more than 30 years old, and yet none have a single vulnerability published by NIST. It's not because the platform is too old, but because the platform is too simple. All of the programming fits into a 32 kilobyte ROM. It's not because my TRS-80s aren't network connected either, because they all have serial ports and dial-up modems. Another example is the Lua programming language, developed by Brazil during isolationist times. Remember how Python has only 34 published vulnerabilities? Like Python, Lua is an older language than PHP, but only one vulnerability has been published in its 25-year history, and it's only of moderate severity, and Lua is still actively maintained. How is it that the Lua language is such a fountain of youth compared to the others? Because the Lua implementation is tiny enough that humans can manage it. It's less than 30,000 lines of code. Its ugly cousin PHP uses 4.9 million lines of code to implement and consequently has belched out 558 vulnerabilities so far, in contrast to Lua's 1. So back to Windows XP. It's insecure why? Because it's old? No, nothing like that. It's insecure because A, it's very large, and B, Microsoft decided after 12 years of trying to stop providing security fixes for their own mistakes. It was very interesting when Windows XP was in diapers and Linux was only 11. I switched from Windows to Linux. My old machines that ran Windows slowly ran Linux quickly. In fact, my end-of-life computers were running faster for me after the change than when they were new out of the box running Windows. The desktop computers at my office are 10 years old, but they're still plenty fast. They have an abundance of hardware security problems that can only be fixed by melting them down or sending them to the landfill. But the new CPUs from Intel aren't sufficiently safer to warrant upgrading, and won't be for a long time. All we can do about Spectre and Meltdown is isolate our machines from untrustworthy code, something we should already be doing because of what we've known from Rice's theorem for these past 68 years. In cybersecurity, some types of problems are a lot easier to solve than others. Protecting a boron control rod in a nuclear reactor is fairly easy if your hardware supply chain is good, because the software to step a motor is like half a page. The hardest application to secure today, in my opinion, is your web browsing. You'll remember I said the source code for Firefox alone has 258,000 files. Well, as of December 31, 2018, there are 1,531 published vulnerabilities that are the consequence of having more than 23 million lines of code, in addition to dozens of dependencies that Mozilla doesn't even control. The six top browsers, Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Internet Explorer, Opera, and Safari, have together over 5,300 known vulnerabilities. But the problems don't end at your machine. What makes bugs in today's browsers so nefarious is the whole-scale hub-and-spoke structure of the World Wide Web. Most browsers have direct connectivity to 3.7 billion IPv4 addresses, and website operators rotate and delegate not only their network addresses, but also the domain names they depend on, like it's a big game of Stump the Dummy. And although there's no technical need for information retrieval to involve JavaScript, there's so much lust for tracking and sex appeal for newfangled developer tricks that many websites won't display a single pixel unless JavaScript is enabled. My best security advice for browsing the World Wide Web is to treat the computer you're using and every website you visit as you would a tuberculosis patient. I know if your intentions weren't noble, you wouldn't be going online. But once online, your system and all information it can access is in harm's way. You're not alone struggling with websites. Even the highest budget organizations cower in front of web browsers, even when they don't have to. My website has a good example of how not to address the issue. Look at the U.S. Department of Defense, which places too much emphasis on commercial off-the-shelf components. That is to say, they use the exact same browsers you and I do, and build a big wall around their networks so that bad people can't get inside. In essence, the admirals and generals have simply mimicked the fences and guards around U.S. military installations. But in reality, they have walled our sergeants and petty officers in a beautiful garden, with most of the world's knowledge assets on the wrong side of that wall. For what the U.S. military spends on their firewall and the lost productivity of our armed services personnel, they could write 10 browsers that have adequate security, safeguards, and reliability. But the talent to accomplish such a project on time and on budget might not be easy to find in the United States. Many of today's leading software geniuses come from our allies, projects such as QEMU, Linux, Python, Minix 3, and even the web itself came from Europeans, although Linus has recently become a U.S. citizen and settled in Oregon. If the U.S. government wanted to fund a security-realistic web browser, some personnel security clearance gymnastics could be necessary. Or the initiative could choke, like so many others, in the hands of the usual contractors. Here's a new topic. At the risk of stereotyping myself further, we have a couple minutes for my thoughts about a common problem which can't be solved by installing or writing friendlier software. What are we to do about distributed denial of service attacks, where thousands of rogue machines collaborate to focus terabits per second at victim systems? Is there anything that can be done? To begin with, DDoS attacks are something of our day and age and take advantage of billions of crappy devices that have come on the market using firmware that was written by the lowest bidder. Moreover, it's only been recently that real attention has been given to internet backbone security, rogue players with high bandwidth connections, and industrial-level transmission of packets that are obvious forgeries, except that no one checked until they were already forwarded, and too late to trace. Another issue is that neither our internet service providers nor our legal systems hold anyone accountable for the actions of their hardware. No one's going to haul my landlord into court when her Nest thermostat tries to take down Wikipedia. More likely, people will say it's Jimmy Wales' problem. But our legal systems are going to catch up, and ownership of computers and software will come with consequences similar to those of owning automobiles. If your car hits somebody's dog, it's the owner of the vehicle, not the driver, who is accountable for the vet bills. Our network operators and Internet of Trash manufacturers will likewise catch up, even as capacity to redirect network problems improves. So DDoS in 20 years isn't going to be the same type of problem it sometimes is today. With that said, there is some critical infrastructure that needs protection from distributed denial of service attacks right now, and my solution is an old one. Some high-value services don't belong on the internet to begin with. They belong on leased lines with guaranteed bandwidth, like ISDN. Your total bandwidth depends only on what you buy and doesn't change over time. I used a leased line every day for a while that crossed North America from South Pasadena in the west to Raleigh-Durham in the east. And as I remember, it was 9,600 bits per second, and the whole office shared it. But no one on the outside could crowd us off the line, because we were its only users. And though leased lines cost a lot of money if they come out of personal funds, they cost very little along the assets they might be protecting on other scales. Moreover, a carrier's cost in providing a leased circuit is lower today than at any time in history, and that cost is going to decrease even more. What remains to be seen is whether there will be enough market interest to pass some of those savings to users. I've saved my hardest subtopic for last. You know, over several years, a lot of hardware vendors have been caught incorporating features that leave the cookie jar wide open to domestic and foreign punks. Intel's past 2 years have been disaster upon disaster, and Cisco, last time I checked, has admitted 6 separate times in 2018 alone to cases where they built a secret backdoor password into their networking and network management products that the end customers weren't told about and couldn't change or remove if they had been. One of the chapters for the book I'm writing is called All Hardware is Broken, but Some is More Broken. I wrote this talk using a microprocessor that has 456 million transistors. As I said, it's 10 years old. Unfortunately, Intel botched its design beyond any hope of usable security through deliberate and accidental misdeeds. But if I ever need a trustworthy CPU, where am I going to turn if neither America nor China have trustworthy suppliers? If it costs $100 million in 3 years to reverse engineer the security of a single chip, and that's being optimistic, then I can't buy silicon-based microprocessors and place them in sensitive applications. No one can. We need a new supply paradigm for secure electronics, a scenario where we fabricate processors ourselves from the transistor up and assemble them on our premises under our supervision. That's not easy today. A modern fab easily costs $10 billion. But we don't need a 5-nanometer facility or even a 30-nanometer plant. If we can get 1.5 microns, that's 1,500 nanometers in our kitchen, we can make an 8286 or even a highly functional 32-bit CPU. That's definitely enough for secure processing in many critical applications, including general office work. I can buy a new DNA sequencer for $1,000. What would it take to scale down semiconductor production in a similar manner? We already have some technology like this in field programmable gate arrays, and New York City hobbyist Chris Fenton has even used one to implement a Cray 1 supercomputer at negligible cost. But FPGAs are still ordinary integrated circuits in a form of copper and silicon that we can't audit and shouldn't trust. One technology we could use right now at medium cost, say $2,000 to $20,000 per CPU, is to assemble processors directly out of surface mount transistors, placing and wave soldering them onto custom boards with relatively inexpensive robots. The traces on the boards are large enough to audit, and you can make a 32-bit processor like the original ARM CPU out of just 25,000 transistors. You might think that's a lot of transistors, but they're a lot only in number. We're using robots. Some of today's surface mount transistors are so small that you can scoop 25,000 of them up in a single teaspoon. Because of low semiconductor prices and the automation we have available, it's less expensive today to make computers out of individual transistors than at any time in history. Whether we'll find a way to make our own chips, or we'll have to solder our own computers together out of single transistors, it's critical to world stability that some technology emerge that enables end users to truly build their own information processing equipment when necessary. If not, tomorrow's worst malware won't come to us through the internet. Instead, it will come baked in on the devices we buy from Verizon, Best Buy, Amazon, and Walmart, including our Nest thermostats. In closing, cybersecurity is popularly regarded as an arms race, where the wit and intellect of the bad guys are pitted against the watchfulness and teamwork of the good guys. Battles are decided, supposedly, in favor of the side that is quickest to adapt. Skirmishes between American interests and forces of instability never stop. It's not a coincidence that the four countries most known for cyber attacks against the United States are the same four that are most known for human rights abuses against their own people. Unfortunately, U.S. treatment of these regimes as plausible opponents in cyberspace tends to legitimize claims of sovereignty with respect to their crimes at home. A permanent American victory in cyberspace is a better strategy than allowing today's arms race to continue according to rules written by China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia. The knowledge exists to win right now, but the information security industry doesn't like the idea. Neither does the rest of the computing industry, for that matter. The status quo guarantees a permanent stream of new sales to keep up with the bad guys. Are we ready to let those sales lag in exchange for actual security in a stronger global economy? You've been listening to Apocalypse Not, Practical Security Against State-Sponsored Shenanigans. My name again is Mark Abel, and I am a life member of the Caltech Alumni Association, as well as the owner of Wakefield Cybersecurity, located near Dayton. You can find me on the web at wakesecure.com.